When historians record the period of COVID-19, it's a fair bet they will focus on the drama and the death count, and they'll probably also employ military metaphors, battles with an unseen enemy, the front line of those who combat the virus. But will they be right? Well, to an extent. In a highly enjoyable piece for The Economist's 1843 magazine, the author and journalist Catherine Nixie notes that for many people, the vast majority, the pandemic age is not one of frontline dramas, but rather of smaller, often tedious struggles on the home front against the endless laundry and the washing up and the enemy of one's own spirits. And she goes on to draw parallels between the time we are living through, certainly the time we're living through, and recollections of the Second World War in Britain, where she notes that nostalgia often overshadows the reality. I talked to Catherine Nixie late yesterday.
Hello. Thank you for having me.
Your piece in The Economist magazine starts with a wonderful anecdote. It's the year late 1940, Britain's darkest hour. France had fallen. Fear of a German invasion hangs in the air. And in England, Virginia Woolf, the author, sits down to record the day's events in her diary. What does she write about? The shortage of margarine and the tedium of housework. I mean, it's hard to imagine a better illustration, I'd suggest to you, of the gulf between war nostalgia and reality.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, history is really a big deceit, because when you are a historian and you're writing a history book, you look for the exciting bits. You look for the bits where people are blown up and houses are bombed and cities are razed to the ground. But in fact, the truth of history, the uncomfortable truth that no historian ever writes about, is that for most of history, nothing happens. That's why we're all still here. And so this is what gets missed. And this is when you're actually living through history, it takes a while for you to realize that this is just what history feels like. History feels, particularly this kind of history, where the world stops a bit and the old things don't happen and the parties don't happen. It just feels like boredom.
Yes. And in fact, Virginia Woolf, she really did wonder about day-to-day life, but she mostly said it was about drawing breath as usual.
Yes, exactly. She has this wonderful description of her day where she talks about, she sits down and says, what does war mean for me this Thursday? And I think it's the this Thursday that's key. Not in general, not in the big abstract, not in the kind of, you know, hearts and minds, but what does it mean for me today? And what it means for her is that she's and her husband are doing the dusting, that the maid is a bit hard to get hold of, that there are queues outside the shops, and that she can't get butter. She has to put up with margarine.
Now, we'll go to how this relates to our own age soon. But first, you do note that the Second World War is increasingly viewed through a rose-tinted lens in the UK. How so?
Oh, it's, you know, if you look at the fashions were nice, the women wore good lipstick. It was also thrilling. And there was such an obvious baddie, the Germans, and there was such an obvious goodie, us. And particularly at the moment, it was a lot of Brexit. I mean, Michel Barnier said that nostalgic nationalism was one of the main causes of Brexit. And it's true. You know, we like bunting. We like our keep calm and carry on posters. We like our kind of Second World War fashions. Tweed is very in. Moustaches are very in. And we recast ourselves as this time when we were obviously better.
You magnificent.
The past is such a powerful political tool because, you know, no one has to pay for the past. But, you know, you can invoke it at your ease and it wins votes. People love it. People like the films. They like the fashions. They like the feeling of being heroes.
Well, yes. I mean, look, you know, the business of, I suppose, reframing it, which like Dunkirk, that was so critical in the film Dunkirk, you know, how they reframed it with the small boats, reframed really a total disaster into something that was a sort of monument to the British fighting spirit, wasn't it?
Yeah, and Churchill himself knew that Dunkirk was a total... When the soldiers come back, when you read the actual accounts, when the soldiers come back on the trains, they were terrified that they were going to be heckled. And Churchill himself said, you know, no one wins wars by running away. But it's now, in our memory, we've repackaged it as this very comfortable place. And the repackaging of history the past is so much more easy to handle than the present. It's been kind of worn smooth by handling. We know what to do with it. But in the time, it was terribly confusing. People didn't know. Millions of Britons were listening to the Nazi propagandist Lord Haw-Haw. Nobody heard the Churchill's "We shall fight them on the beaches" speech as it happened. It wasn't recorded until after the war. When you hear recordings of Churchill, that's from years later.
Look, I had no idea about that. Your piece alerted me to that. So it was reported, obviously, in the newspapers, this magnificent speech in the Commons, but it wasn't recorded until after the war.
No. And what's really interesting is when you read, the British government had a daily report on morale in which they described what people were listening to, particularly on the radio. And the people who they were listening to on that day after that speech, Churchill doesn't get a mention. Everybody prefers another completely forgotten British politician called Duff Cooper. And millions of ordinary Britons are instead listening to Lord Haw-Haw, who was the famous Nazi propagandist. Nobody sat down and had their hackles raised by "We shall fight them on the beach," as "We shall fight them on the landing grounds," and they just didn't hear it.
I really think listeners will be slack-jawed at this, you know, so there's just no better example of somebody. I mean, the current word is spinning, but somebody must have propagandized about that big time, mustn't they?
This is, again, I think this is the foreshortening effect of history. You don't look at all the dull, like, valleys of where nothing happens. You look at the peaks, and that speech is, you know, he was so gifted as an orator. It's an absolute corker. No historian wouldn't put it in, and then you'd put it next to what's happening. And then gradually the foreshortening effect means that you don't see the joins. It looks like they're all standing close together, these events.
But obviously Duff Cooper was a heck of an orator too, by the sound of it.
Well, he must have been. We've completely forgotten him again. Who knows what Duff Cooper did? Most people know him now as being married to Lady Diana
indeed.
Cooper, who wrote a good diary and had lots of affairs.
Well, that's right. She was one of the diarists. You're quite right. But the Daily Morale report, compiled by the Ministry of Information, which all sounds very Orwellian, who put these reports together and why?
So these reports, actually, I think it was Duff Cooper who started them. They realised that they couldn't speak to the country without first listening to the country. So it was a Ministry of Information set up with historians, this organisation where people would go out every day into Britain. It was an enormous organisational effort. And they'd go and sit on buses, in pubs, on the street, and they'd listen. They'd literally eavesdrop to the conversations that were around them, and they would write down what they were hearing. And every day at midday, they would phone back into central London and say, "This is what they're saying." And it is the most extraordinary record of the war. If you want to know what the Second World War felt like, don't listen, don't read any of the famous history books, chuck them all in the bin and buy this book, because it's daily, it's quotidian, it's people grumbling about shortages of butter. And it's also actually, shockingly, not very much to our credit. In the sepia films, Britain is this amazing land of liberty. And actually what you hear is loads of people complaining about an influx of Belgians who are eating all the butter. And they don't like foreigners, they don't like the Italians, they don't like the Jews, they really don't like the Catholics. So I was brought up, my mother was a monk and a nun, and I was brought up Catholic. And what's interesting to me is how anti-Catholic people are, because it's a dislike that's almost forgotten today, but they absolutely loathe the Catholics. And there's an amazing bit where the RAF have bombed Turin, and somebody eavesdropping in Tunbridge Wells, which is a very, very parochial English town.
Okay.
They profess themselves in and these old ladies in Tunbridge Wells are apparently well satisfied by the bombing of Italian Catholics. So there's all these currents that we've just totally forgotten, because history has a simplifying effect. It knocks off the confusing edges. It likes to forget that we didn't like the Jews either, probably, and that we were all a bit racist.
And the propaganda units, you know, were busy, as we say, thinking up slogans and campaigns to keep morale up. "Keep calm and carry on" was one example. But in their time, a lot of these slogans and campaigns were viewed as a bit of a disaster, weren't they?
Well, "Keep Calm and Carry On" is a really interesting example. I don't know how popular it is in Australia, but for a few years ago, you couldn't move for it here. You know, we had it on mugs, we had it on posters, T-shirts. You can recognise posters that copy it just by its font alone. And it was an absolute disaster in the war. They printed 2.5 million posters saying keep calm and carry on. And then they sent out their observers and actually they realized that everyone was calm. Everyone was not just calm. They were actually really bored already. And then so they realized that they didn't need to be told to keep calm. Actually, the British people probably needed to be told to take this seriously because they weren't. And that's another interesting thing. At the beginning of the war, everyone thought it was just not that real, a bit like, you know, it reminded me a lot of the current crisis. People couldn't take it seriously and the government were wringing their hands trying to work out how to make people listen.
That happened here and then, too. That very much happened
yeah.
here.
Mm. And then the end of the keep calm and carry on poster thing was that the other thing they thought was that it wasn't a very good message and people might get annoyed if everyone kept telling them to keep calm.
Yes, and there is this tendency to hold up the Blitz in particular as a template. And our own Prime Minister at the time, Robert Menzies, was there during, and he was completely transformed and stayed away from Australia for a good 9 to 10 months. And it fundamentally affected the course of events in so many ways because he thought it was just so magnificent. But actually, there was quite a lot of fragmentation then as there is now, wasn't there?
Well, because there were those who were doing fine and then there were those who were not doing fine. So there were the rich were probably okay, the people who could stockpile food. You know, we look back fondly on rationing as a time when, you know, the great paternalistic government looked after us. But the reason that rationing came in was because that just as in coronavirus, the people who had money and the people who had the time to go to the shops went in, bought everything they needed and swept the shelves clean. And then there were lots of other people who had nothing. And so there were rich and poor did differently well and resented each other. And the town and the country had completely different experiences. And to an extent, you know, it's interesting reading Virginia Woolf's diary because she describes what it was like. You know, her maid's hours are difficult. That's different. So that was difficult for her. And she goes to look at her house in London and she sees the room where she's written all her most famous novels has been bombed. And now dust is just falling, this sort of black snow from the top of the building onto her books. And the wall is gone. And it's this kind of almost doll's house view of her room open to the air. But for Woolf, this is a kind of thing to observe because she has another house in Kent. It would be a much less of a just thing to observe if, like many of the other people in London, she had nowhere else to live.
And did they talk about this? Can you find evidence of them, you know, wrestling with this? Because that's certainly happening in Australia, and I know it's happening elsewhere too, you know, that there are different experiences. Or was this all just taken as part of the normal course of events?
Well, one of the interesting things that you get from mass observation is they have no qualms about discussing class when they talk about these things.
Now, and we should just say mass observation was this fascinating group that set up to do the first sort of observational work in the world. And it was very crude, but it's provided this amazing template, isn't it, for the observation of populations, which was then taken up post-war.
Yes, exactly. And these were the people, mass observation were the people who were going out into the pubs and looking at people and writing down what they were saying. And they had no qualms about ranking people by class. And one of the things they observe is that the most anxious are, in fact, the most well-off. So they found that the most optimistic were what they called the kind of lower classes who all thought it would be fine. And then the people who were the worst were middle-class women, generally, sitting at home wringing their hands.
I should just sort of bring back to this, to what else emerged from this, this longing for escape and a better life, expressed back then in a literary genre that I'd never heard of, you mentioned hunger novels. What were they?
This is a term coined by the critic Laura Freeman, and it's all of those novels that you think of when you think of the war. When we think of the war, we think of people having a lot of fun, and in fact, it was, as Woolf shows, drudgery. But one of the reasons we think it was so much fun was that all these people living in this drudgy, dreary time wrote with this utter yearning of the time when it had been fun. So you get people like Evelyn Waugh writing his most famous novel, Brideshead Revisited. And he wrote, you know, this novel of Oxford, of picnics, of lying under oak trees, of sipping champagne, of eating strawberries and the juice running down your fingers. Then it's that sense of kind of, you know, having life, taking a big bite out of life, that sense of youth and fun and excitement. And you assume that Evelyn Waugh, because he was a party boy, you assume he wrote it when he was having a party, but he didn't. He wrote it during the Second World War when he was laid up with an injury. And he describes it as being in a land of England of Spam and bully beef, which are two kind of completely forgotten tinned meats. And it was dreary and it was boring and there was no fun. And he wrote it as a sort of
yes.
explosion of nostalgia.
I wonder what our age will spawn then in terms of literature.
Well, you imagine it will be a novel that what we crave is, so for war, it was, who famously ate all his children's bananas at the end of the war. When the government finally gave children bananas, it gave every child in the country one banana, and war had five children. His wife took the tokens, got the bananas, they brought them back. War arranged his five children around him and then peeled and ate every banana in front of them with cream.
Is that true, is it?
Yeah, Oberyn Waugh, his son, writes about it in his memoirs. And I can't quite remember. He says something like, I didn't hate my father from that moment on, but clearly probably did.
Oh, dear, oh, dear. Oh, I'm sure we Australians wouldn't do that. Look, Catherine, how enjoyable to talk to you. Thank you very much indeed.
Thank you. Thank you. Lovely to speak to you.
And that's author and journalist Catherine Nixie. And we've put a link to her article, The Death of Nostalgia, on the Saturday Extra website. She also wrote The Darkening Age, The Christian Destruction of the Classical World, which is a very well-regarded book.